Going to continue from First Canto Bhagavatam, reading from the 16th chapter. You might wonder why going from 12th chapter to 16th chapter. One of the reasons is the connection at the end of the 12th chapter jumps right away to the 16th chapter. The 12th chapter ends with Maharaj Parikshit, Jatakarma being performed, the brahmanas and priests remunerated, and the ceremony is over. So, not chronological, but chapter 13 jumps to another important point. It's the deliverance of Dhritarashtra. Vidura returns to the royal palace, and there's that whole deliverance of Dhritarashtra discussion. And then chapters 14 and 15 where they're waiting for Arjuna to return because Krishna left several chapters ago. Krishna left for Dwaraka, and Arjuna was sent with Krishna to find out what's next. And Krishna hasn't returned. Excuse me, Arjuna hasn't returned, and there's all this speculation about all these inauspicious omens and what's going on. And then chapter 15, he returns. And he discloses that Krishna left. And he's feeling terribly sad. And he begins to speak about his feelings towards Krishna. And as he speaks about his association with Krishna, he comes to the dialogue of Bhagavad Gita, and he remembers the dialogue of Bhagavad Gita. And by remembering the message of Bhagavad Gita, he becomes revived. And he becomes more than revived, he becomes enlivened. And he realizes that Krishna actually made this special arrangement so that he could feel Krishna's presence even in his physical absence by remembering his instructions. So, that ends chapter 15. And then chapter 16 begins where chapter 12 ends. Read the first verse. Sutta Goswami said, O learned Brahmanas, Sutta speaking to the sages, Maharaj Parikshit then began to rule over the world as a great devotee of the Lord under the instructions of the best of the twice-born Brahmanas. I forgot something. It says, it uses this metaphor that as the fortnight of the waxing moon, gradually the moon increases in its brightness, so also through the light of Maharaj Parikshit, all that was foretold, he became. He became all of that by the mercy of Krishna. So now he's ruling. Under the instructions of the best of the twice-born Brahmanas, he ruled by those great qualities which were foretold by expert astrologers at the time of his birth. His marriage, his first son, Janamejaya, so his ruling as the king is described, and how happy the citizens were and so forth. And then he gets this news. In one sense, very bad news. In your kingdom, there's a bad person. bad person is really bad. He's the personality of bad persons. He's the personality of Kali. And he's has a club and he's beating on the legs of a bull right in a public place, and he's dressed like a king, but he's behaving like anything but a king. So it's very bad news, but on the other hand, Prabhupada explains, it's good news because he's a Kshatri, now he has some service, some chivalrous service to do. So he immediately assembles his entire army to go deal with this one guy as the personality of Kali. And he, as he's traveling in the direction of where this report has come from, he stops in each place, city, where there's another king, and the other king receives him, and the cultural point is that there are bards, which we don't have today, they're theatrical people today, and because theatrical people today, you know, it's anything. And at that time it was the lineage of great kings. They were very learned in they're historians, and they would sing. I was reading a translation of Chaitanya Bhagavat, where the annotation explains, or the author, Vrindavan Das Thakur, had specific meter and melody by which different verses were to be sung. So, specifically, it comes at the point where Krishna, where Lord Chaitanya is going to leave home. So it tells the raga. There's a raga in music. It's not just, you know, the melody. It invokes a particular mood. Different ragas are for different times of the day, as well as different ragas are for stirring emotion in a particular way. Sometimes excitement, sometimes sadness, sometimes celebration, sometimes confrontation. So different notes do different things. So there's this certain raga. So when learned persons became learned in those matters, and so the bards in the places where Maharaj Parikshit visited, they sang the glories of the Pandavas, who just happened to be his grandparents, the lineage of the previous kings. So he was, as he was hearing, he was feeling ecstatic symptoms, because it wasn't just, oh my, I have such a wonderful grandfather. It's in relation to Krishna. Prabhupada described like this, that when he was a young boy, not so that as recent as when I was a young boy, Prabhupada would say, whenever there was a festival, always the festival was some kind of drama or recitation or some of this musical invoking of the glorification of the personality of Godhead. So that the whole society was focused on the personality of Godhead, and that was the festival. Now, you know, something else, Taste of Chicago, for example. That invoking remembrance of the personality of Godhead. Or so many things. I heard there was this, where we may take part in St. Patrick's Day Parade in Naperville. But, you know, in New York City, it's just a rowdy bash. They have like triple the police force because there's just people that are running around the streets, wild, intoxicated, crazy, etc. In New York, there's so many street fairs, you know, with Saint somebody or other fair, Saint Jerome. And it's just you know, intoxication, meat-eating madness. All night long, noise and dirt and filth and smell and crazy. Saint this one, saint this. It's, things have deteriorated so badly. So badly. Anyway, we all are familiar with these things. So, at the time of Maharaj Parikshit, that wasn't the case. So he's experiencing ecstatic symptoms as he's going off to deal with this personification of badness in the personality of Kali. So then, Suta Goswami says, "Now you may hear from me of what happened when Maharaj Parikshit was passing his days, hearing of the good occupations of his forefathers and being absorbed in thoughts of them. The personification of religious principles, Dharma, was wandering about in the form of a bull. He met the personality of earth in the form of a cow, who appeared to grieve like a mother would, lost her child. She had tears in her eyes, and the beauty of her body was lost. Thus Dharma questioned Mother Earth as follows." So this is a verse that we discussed the other morning. I'm losing track of time. The other morning. Saturday morning. Sunday morning. And in the verse, it's important because it's a theme message. The message is that good qualities become deteriorated by the influence of the age of Kali, and the antidote to that deterioration of good qualities is promotion of Brahminical culture and protection of Brahminical culture. And how that can be made possible in this age of Kali is by the direct means of awakening God consciousness by hearing and chanting. When awakening of God consciousness by hearing and chanting comes, then morality and good qualities follow. Brahminical culture follows, if it's done properly. And thus, by establishing Brahminical culture, then in turn, the other affairs of culture, he gives the examples of music and dance, like, you know, we discussed the cultural affairs department of the city, but culture in a different sense, you know, the worldly features of life, the things that human society requires, that kind of sense of culture. When the duties of society are performed properly, then under the direction of qualified brahmanas, then the finer qualities of people come forward. So the picture here is there's like this epicenter, and then concentric circles expanding out from that epicenter, and the epicenter is this, the activities of hearing and chanting to awaken God consciousness, and from that follows something, follows something, follows something. The concentric circles expand out for the purpose of bringing about peace and prosperity into the world. That's very clearly Prabhupada's explicit vision in expanding the message of Srimad Bhagavatam by teaching it, by distributing these books, by, most important, by living the example of the message of these books, by regularly performing these activities. We as individuals then in turn concentric circles out. Benefit, provided we do properly. And then Prabhupada explains when that's not being performed, then there's also concentric circles out consequences. And that's what's being presented. The format of the presentation is a dialogue between Dharma and Mother Earth. So, Dharma begins to speak. Text number 19. You may have heard this before. I've heard it hundreds of times because it was the beginning of a drama, The Age of Kali. The Vaikuntha players performed this. I used to hear them rehearsing every day. And then saw the drama many, many times in New York. Prabhupada saw the drama also. It was such a nice building that we had, 55th Street. We had a separate space that was just a theater with actual theater seats and a theater stage and a, you know, on and off stage. It was, anyway. Dharma, in the form of a bull, asked, "Madam, are you not hale and hearty? Why are you covered by the shadow, with the shadow of grief? It appears by your face that you have become black. Are you suffering from some internal disease? Or are you thinking of some relative who is away at a distant place?" Oh, there's a short purport, and then the next verse has a 3-page purport, so I'll just briefly summarize this one. He starts, "The people of this age are always full of anxieties. And those anxieties produce ailments of all different descriptions. Everyone is diseased with some kind of ailment. From the very faces of the people of this age, one can find out the index of the mind. And so for me, when I travel, it's very easy to especially these days when flights get canceled. when I came here to Chicago from Houston, it took all day to get here. I was really happy to get here because flights were canceled and it was, you know, it was crazy weather. When I came out of the plane, I saw a line that started from the middle of the airport and went, you know, the gates, and went practically to the security check area. And we just went up to somebody and said, "What's this line for?" I think they were motioning like, "Get to the end of the line, man." They said, "This is for all the people that had their flights canceled." And I said, "You know, I'm not looking to jump in the line here with you, I'm just feeling very sorry that you..." It's holiday time and you may not get to your destination. I feel very fortunate that I was able to make it. Took all day long. Anyway, the face is the index to the mind. The particular symptoms of the age of Kali is that no family is now blessed to live together. And he's speaking here of the extended family. The son is here, the daughter is there, and people all over, and even that changes, and it changes, and it changes, and it's true. And sometimes, you know, the husband is here, the wife is over there, and things like that. And then the overall anxiety produces diseases. So you have people have internal diseases and all kinds of difficulties. And then anxiety for maintaining the status quo. You know, this calamity and that calamity. And someone's going along and all of a sudden the next thing at the bottom just fell out. And it's very difficult. People have their homes and have their families, the next thing you know, they don't have a job. They got their mortgage, and they got their you know, they've worked so how many years to set up that house of cards, and a wind came along, and the house of cards fell over. They don't have anything. They don't know where the next meal ticket's going to come from. You know, pass in the hat. What are they going to do? It's very, very... And then, you know, the persons that see that happening wonder, when's that going to happen to me? How secure is my situation? And so on, and so on, and so on. It's just so many varieties of the temporary nature. The message, you know, it's how many times can you throw the dice until you lose? It's not a good program, throwing dice. It's an illusory existence. And building happiness on illusory existence in the age of Kali, it's maintaining status quo. Then he goes on. He gives four other items in text 20. So, first one. I have, he's standing there on one leg because the other three legs are broken. I have lost my three legs and am now standing on one only. Are you lamenting for my state of existence? So Prabhupada discusses this principles of religion. Three quarters are gone. One is remaining, and even that's wobbling. Truthfulness. Or, are you in great anxiety because henceforward the unlawful meat-eaters will exploit you? Second. Or, are you in a sorry plight because the demigods are now bereft of their share of sacrificial offerings because no sacrifices are being performed at present in the age of Kali? Or are you grieving for living beings because of their suffering due to famine and drought? So these are, going back to the theme, these are not just symptoms of the age of Kali. This is due to the influence of Kali, but it's back to the stem message or source is Brahminical culture. Without proper direction, the culture becomes deteriorated. It becomes abominable. You know, no culture and the culture of no culture. So, the remedy that the Bhagavatam is providing for us and Prabhupada is emphasizing is Brahminical culture. Again, how do you bring that Brahminical culture back? By awakening of God consciousness. Because by birth alone is not doing it. So, purport. I'll read sections because it's quite long, not the whole thing. With the progress of the age of Kali, four things particularly, namely, duration of life, mercy, the power of recollection, and moral or religious principles, will gradually diminish. Since Dharma, or the principle of religion, would be lost in the proportion of three out of four, the symbolic bull was standing on one leg only. When three-fourths of the population of the whole world becomes irreligious, the situation is converted into hell for the animals. In the age of Kali, godless civilizations will create so many so-called religious societies in which the personality of Godhead will be directly or indirectly defied. I shared this previously, I'll do it again, because it just came to my attention. A nice devotee, you know, a regular sadhaka in some temple not here in Chicago, I was visiting. And the some discussion came up about our view on Gandhi. So I shared with him what Gandhi's view on religiosity is, because he wrote, he didn't just like do peace walks and things. He wrote, and you know, in a very humble way, my view of religion, or something like that. And his view of religion is impersonal. For example, explicitly, he was asked, I'll just give two examples. One example is his constant chanting of Ram. He's famous, he's constantly chanting of Ram, very wonderful. But when he was chanting Ram, what was he thinking? He's not thinking what we're thinking. Specifically, he was asked, in something that you wrote, you spoke of Ram as the son of Dasarath and the husband of Sita. Could you explain? Did you mean that literally? And he said, I've spoken on this many times because you're so asking so directly, I'll give a direct answer. No. There was no Dasarath, there was no Sita, there was no Ram. When I chant Rams, when I think of Ram, it's then he went off in this, you know, this other thing. This force of life. Ram, 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 Ram. Okay. And another one. There was no Kurukshetra battle. Krishna did not induce Arjuna to fight. If I have to accept that this happened, there was some person, Krishna, that did this, if that's required for my being a Hindu, I reject Hinduism. Rather, Krishna was blah, 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 blah. Explicit. And he's, you know, a modern saint. Maybe people haven't read what his views are, but his views are strong in the area of social service. You know, people bonding together and helping one another and doing things to build cottage industries so that we have our indigenous strength. We're not depending upon the British and their useless products, just becoming a commercial market for all of their stuff. We should have our own, you know, agriculture-based, those kinds of things, people like that. But as far as, you know, for whom are we doing all that? May the force be with you. And that's one example of a prominent modern example. Where is that? Yeah. In this age of Kali, godless civilizations will create so many so-called religious societies in which the personality of God will be directly or indirectly defied. So some religious principles become God. Nonviolence. And even what nonviolence is not what nonviolence is. Because there's no standard. Just share this again. Long time ago, there was a high school youth. He's now a PhD in astrophysics. No, nuclear something. Something physics. From Stanford University. You know, a brilliant young man. So he was 16 and he was the top student in his state going on to college with a full scholarship. bright young man, asked me, how do I answer this question when kids at school ask, why are you a theist? Why are you not a moral, you know, just be a good person, an agnostic moralist? Because, be honest, if God exists or not, you don't know. So, that's agnostic. But you do know that you should be a good person just because it's right to be a good person. So, why do you insist on being a theistic moralist instead of an agnostic moralist? How do I answer that question? Maharaj. He said, I've asked my mom and dad many times, but, you know, I haven't gotten an answer that I'm satisfied with. And they said, that's why we invited Maharaj to come. So I was in the hot seat. But one of the answers that I gave a few answers, but one of them is, first of all, there's this conviction that you have and I have that there is God. Where does order come from? Nothing, etc. The teleological argument. But then, how do you maintain morality if there's no standard? If what is considered, for example, nonviolence. What's nonviolence? What's the standard of nonviolence? You know, you've got your idea and I've got my idea, and go back in time and they had their idea, go forward in time and they've got their idea. There's no standard because there's no authority. So the Veda says that the standard comes from God. And that is, you know, time may change, but standard doesn't change. I gave the example, there's a devotee I know in New York that was involved with the Board of Education and did some study 20 years ago. What did it take to get kicked out of a classroom? And today, what does it take to get kicked out of a classroom? Maybe it was 10 years ago. One of them was, if you didn't raise your hand before speaking, the teacher would ask you to leave the room, go to the principal's office. Another one was a spit wad. Maybe, I don't know what that is, but paper that's soaked, and then they throw it, it would stick to something. If you threw a spit wad, you get kicked out of the classroom. And if you spoke harsh words to your fellow classmate, you were kicked out of the classroom. Now it's, you know, you have a gun in your hand. Or you make a verbal challenge that you'll kill your teacher, you can be kicked out of the classroom. Or if you physically hit your classmate, you assault your classmate, you can be kicked out of the classroom. In the New York public school system, because they have records of those standards, etc. So when there's no authority, there's no standard. It's just totally subjective. What is considered to be, just like when I grew up, the Bible said, thou shalt not kill. And I went away to college and I, you know, got too busy with doing things and find out later it reads differently. Thou shalt not murder. What happened? Somebody did a little editing job. Now it's a whole lot, then that's a commandment, you know, like one of the 10 principal pillars. It just changed. What happened? A lot of vegetarians were saying, you know, eating meat is killing. So then it became murder. That's what happened. Convenience. The other was inconvenient. So it disappeared. So when this, without a standard, anything happens. And when anything happens, it does. It can happen, it does happen. So man-made religion is not religion. So many examples. So many. Too many. And thus faithless societies of men will make the world uninhabitable for the saner section of people. Then there's a whole section here about there's gradations of society, and he describes based upon faith. So then the topmost are the Vaishnavas and the Brahmanas, and then the Kshatriyas, and then the Vaishyas, and then the Sudras, and the Mulechas, and the Chandalas, and then off the map, measured in gradations of faith. So, supposing someone is not born in a very fortunate circumstance, are they stuck? He explains, no. By association, by seeking the quality association, one can develop the qualities like that, regardless of place of birth and all of those other things. Body, gender, language, color, nothing to do with it. And more as Kali Yuga progresses, it's just a blur. So the principles of elevation is this principle of association. This is on this topic of in this the pillars that are broken. The pillar of morality and religious principle broken. In the matter of meat eating, Prabhupada specifically says the term mlecha does not apply to those who follow the Vedic principle of according to the standard proper sacrifice. And when there's proper sacrifice, it doesn't mean cows and bulls. Certain animals in certain conditions and a certain procedure, that is one thing. But today, that even that doesn't happen, and so it's practically speaking mlechas and yavanas. Those of you that have passed through India lately will know that it's going down the tube so fast. In the Delhi Indira Gandhi Airport, there's a McDonald's. And shamelessly, people are going up and I'll take two of those and four of those. Right in the airport. In Mathura, there's a McDonald's. Hare Krishna. As far as sacrifice, Prabhupada comments, in this age of Kali, people don't perform sacrifice. They don't even know what it is. At least according to the codes of the Vedas, nor are the proper brahmanas to perform them. People are not engaged in these things. He quotes Bhagavad Gita chapter 3, 14 through 16, that this must be done. Yajnartat karmano yatra lokoyam karma bandhana. Our activities must be sanctified through proper sacrifice, and otherwise it's binding upon the performer. And that binding upon the performer means the karma is being further deepened, and the modes of nature are also, it's just pulling us down instead of possibly at least becoming a little elevated. Then he describes the fruit of sacrifice is rain. There's this, it's in Bhagavad Gita, in one purport, this Chandogya Upanishad cycle of from sacrifice comes rain, and from rain comes grain, and the human society eats the grain, and then from the eating of the grain, living entities are present. The man begets a child and the wife, or the mother, and a child is born and should be trained to perform sacrifice. When the sacrifice is performed, then there's rain, and the cycle continues like that. Here he gives a Manusamhita rendering. In the Manusamhita, it is recommended that by offerings of sacrifice on the altar of the fire, on the altar of the fire, the sun god is pleased. So grains and ghee are offered into the sacrificial fire. The sun god is pleased. When the sun god is pleased, he properly collects water from the sea. This is how it works, as he's explaining. And thus sufficient clouds collect on the horizon, and rains fall. After sufficient rains fall, there's sufficient production of grains for men and all animals. And thus there is energy in the living being for productive, progressive activity. That's the Vedic system. And by following that Vedic system, necessities of life are supplied. So then, in order to not have the necessities of life but have big industry, that land is needed. Anyway, it's just, when I was in India recently, there was a strike because Tata wanted to buy up a whole big bunch of farmland. So those of you who are from India know how that works. The agriculturalists protested by just getting out on the Delhi Agra road and blocked the road so no traffic could pass. So it made headlines and went on for a few days, a week or something like that. And guess who won? Tata bought the land. The agriculturalists were without the land. It's just, you know, progress must go on, right? But maybe they were given something else and compensate, you know, here's some money and see you guys later. Or, you know, progress must go on. Very strongly, Prabhupada would speak about these points. You know, you can't survive on nuts and bolts. You can survive on grains. And to have grains, you need land, and you need rain. You need agriculture. So, displacing the New York Times was calling it the peasants. But, you know, in case you don't know, that's a demeaning term. Peasants were protesting. The peasant farmers protesting the progress of India. This material world is a sort of prison house, as we have several times mentioned. The demigods are the servants of the Lord who see to the proper upkeep of the prison house. These demigods want to see that the rebel living beings who want to survive faithlessly are gradually turned towards the supreme power of the Lord. Therefore, the system of offering sacrifice is recommended in the scriptures. So this is a whole other perspective on sacrifice, besides it produces rains, produce grains, and so on. It's this other idea of how it's intended by the demigods themselves and the Supreme Lord Narayana. Why does he supply this system? For persons that want their necessities of life, they get their necessities of life, but live in a somewhat religious way, a authentic religious way, so they can recognize ultimately the Supreme Authority, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and fulfill their mission of life, ultimately, of going back to Godhead. That's part of the intention of this process of sacrifice. So Dharma is asking Mother Earth, in the form of a cow, are you lamenting because that's not happening now? And as a result, people are suffering due to famine and drought. We're almost finished with the purport, and then we'll end. The last paragraph. The materialistic men want to work hard and enjoy fruitive results for sense enjoyment. there's a Western perspective on this is it's called the Protestant ethic. You heard that term before? The Protestant ethic. Donna Kelly's heard it. Richard Schaub has heard it. You've heard it. Okay. Those of you that aren't educated. In the ways of degradation. Protestant ethic is work hard. You know, like the Protestants that came to America, the pilgrims that came to America, it was tough. They didn't have any of the infrastructure. There was just wilderness. But Protestant ethic, work hard. And God will help you prosper. And oh, did they prosper? And so lots of people became Protestants. They moved away from Catholicism and worked hard. And prospered, and then gave up the churches. Thus they are committing many by this fruit, working hard and enjoying fruitive results of sense enjoyment, thus they are committing many types of sins at every step of life. Those, however, who are consciously engaged in devotional service of the Lord are transcendental to all varieties of sin and virtue. Their activities are free from the contamination of the three modes of material nature. For the devotees, there is no need for performance of prescribed sacrifices. Why is that? Because the very life of the devotee is a symbol of sacrifice. But persons who are engaged in fruitive activities for sense enjoyment must perform the prescribed sacrifices, or else devotional service. Because that is the only means to get free from the reaction of all sins committed by fruitive workers. Sacrifice is the means for counteracting such accumulated sins. The demigods are pleased, and when the sacrifices are performed, just as prison officers are satisfied when the prisoners are turned into obedient subjects. Final remark is, in this age of Kali, Lord Chaitanya taught that in this, according to the scripture, those means of sacrifice are not effective, not successful, for many reasons previously mentioned, and so he recommends Sankirtan. So as now we're back at the epicenter, we're taking up this practice of chanting the holy name, and we're meant to encourage others to also take up the process of chanting the holy name as the yajna for this age, for our benefit and for their benefit. And it's for the upliftment of society, the restoring of some degree of purity in the unregulated section of society, and to help them also become qualified to understand the message of Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. Three people sent me this thing in Seton Hall University. Maybe some of you have seen this. They're requiring that everyone goes to Seton Hall, a Catholic school, takes a class in Bhagavad Gita.
I read that.
You read that?
Yes.
Then they gave the name of the author. I can only imagine what that rendering of Bhagavad Gita is. It's probably something in the direction of Gandhi's Bhagavad Gita. Something that's impersonal. And how are people going to understand the message of Bhagavad Gita, although it's mandatory? So, in one sense, it's a step, it's a nice step in the direction of, I mean, the language of the person who made that decision was, we're a multicultural organization, right? A multicultural society, and people should be understanding and appreciating the cultures of other societies and so on. Such a, you know, fundamental text. It's a mandatory course for anyone that graduates from Seton Hall. to learn about impersonalism. Oh, that's what Bhagavad Gita is. That's going to be the consequence. So we have a lot of work to do. A lot of brahminical work to do. To educate ourselves and to become qualified educators within society, both by our actions and as well as our words and as well as by our qualities. So hearing the Srimad Bhagavatam on a regular basis is to help establish that. Srinvata Sukata Krishna Punya Shravana Kirtana Hridyantaksto Yavadrani Vidhunoti Saritsatam. There's solace in that message after, you know, contemplating the chaos around us. The chaos is increasing, I'm noticing. Increasing. And with the information age, as they call it, misinformation is abundantly available. And those who are, especially through the internet, hyperactive. And some statistic of how much of education today comes via the internet, some large percentage of education comes that way, people in general. Our challenge is formidable. Okay, so any comments or questions for anyone? Yes, there are problems.
I actually have a question about social justice.
Okay.
Mentioning Gandhi and mentioning the peasant strike.
Yeah.
Is it enough for us to do our work and do our service and try and grow in our own Krishna consciousness? Or do we have a responsibility to act in the world and try and
make a
change, whether it's political or economic or...
Well, two things. The root of bringing about a change for a Vaishnava, a Vaishnava understands what's at the root of change. Bad or good. And it's the root of change is at the soul level, not at the social level. To whatever degree we involve ourselves with some degree of, and by the way, for the audience in general, social activism is like way up there on the campuses in college today. The litmus test I've gotten is that some more than others, but it's in general, it's a buzz. So, those involved with social activism that I've discussed with on college campuses find that people aren't ready to make a change. I mean, like the statement, they're in such anxiety to maintain the status quo. Change is cosmetic. Like, for example, consumer economics. So, the solution is, the change is green economics. It addresses nothing about the absorption in consumption. Just consume green. And there's not enough, even recyclable green. It's not enough. It's greed. How do you bring about that change? It's at the soul, it's at the heart level. Or vegetarianism. You know, so many things. It just, something came in the, someone forwarded some newspaper article. published that said far more than, you know, something like, if one person became a vegetarian instead of meat eater, it would be like, it would surpass that, the amount of air pollution compared to, you know, 100 people buying whatever they call those Priuses. Since, you know, because, huh?
Hybrids.
Yeah, so he knows. So, but people aren't going to do that. You know, they may be forced to do that just because there's not enough to go around. When it's at the, you know, but then they'll try to figure out some way to do it. Take it from the other guy that is weaker. Because of greed. So the more fundamental than the social change will have to rest on something that's more fundamental. You know, the quality that's in one's heart. And how do you deal with that? Got to come from a spiritual solution. So that's a conviction that the devotee, so we can be, as much as a devotee wants, sees the need to, for some change over here, put more energy over here. Because that's what grows the, you know, the lack of it is what grows the problem. It's like the example of prayaschitta, where you're dealing with prarabdha karma. Prarabdha karma means karma that's fructifying now. And there's karma that's about to fructify, and there's karma that's still in seed. So it's like, you know, if your lawn is filled with weeds, just get out the lawnmower and mow the lawn. But that doesn't solve the problem, because the weed is still there. It'll just come back in a couple of days, and there it is again. Mow your lawn again. Well, you'll want every 5 minutes. But you have to pull the weed. So you can get out some, you know, whatever you call it, aside, pesticide, or, you know, kill the weeds. Then you contaminate the soil. You know, just pull the weed. Then you know, there's a hole in the ground. You put something else in its place. So our best service is to influence those who are social activists to see a spiritual foundation for their work. Otherwise, you're not going to be successful. We want you to be successful. You do that work, we'll do this work. They'll say, "Why don't you come and help us?" We are. We're helping you. We want you to be successful. This is our part of making that change. And what Prabhupada writes in Sri Isha Upanishad is that one of the, it sounds like a Bhakti Siddhanta statement, one of the greatest detriments for advancing in spiritual understanding is what has become the expectation for religious organizations to become social welfare organizations. In fact, now the government is giving money to the religious organizations to do what the government should be doing, which is social welfare, saying as long as they get the job done, we'll give them the money. It's, you know, it's a government job. They want to do a government job instead of the religious job, fine, we'll give them the money. But that's not that. So people have that expectation. You're a religious person. What's your social activism? What are you doing to, you know, help people? But the soul is missing. The foundation is missing. So we have all this other thing happening. Something else? Yes.
I think it's one of the verses, but also Srila Prabhupada describes a couple of times in the Bhagavad Gita
that Krishna is the governing principle of the material manifestation.
Okay, he sure is.
And without having some deeper understanding, I haven't really understood that.
That's a very broad topic. Can you narrow it down a little bit?
It came up to my mind just based on this conversation about how there has to be some standard there for things to relate in order.
Yeah.
And that's where it came from.
The governing principle is the verse Maya Jakshina Prakriti. By his adyaksha, by his supervision. Aksha means eyes. By his adyaksha, by his overseeing things, by his supervision, everything happens. He doesn't even have to like lift a pinky or get on the phone and say, you know, can you take care of this? He just sees it, and by his will, things happen. So it is he who is to be satisfied. And corresponding to, just going back to the verse, to keep resonating with that, according to the faith of the particular individual who's doing some duty in life, Krishna certainly sees the faith of the individual, their intent. Is their intent sense gratification, selfishness, I want, or is their intent service unto the Supreme, satisfying the Supreme? So the highest level is this Vaishnava level. That's our training. So, you know, we do our part and let Krishna do his part. He's the maintainer and superintendent of the whole creation. We have some service to do, some part of whatever it is. That's our nature. We should do that in the mood of trying to please Krishna under proper direction. I'm not sure if... Am I satisfying the question, or it's all over...
I think more than satisfying.
Okay. Yes.
Maharaj, with this concrete jungle that is happening, you know, deforestation, taking over the land and putting buildings and structures,
yeah,
all over, not only in the United States, all over the world.
All over the world.
I'd like your comment on, you know, as to how will the world have resources?
They won't.
To really survive.
They won't. It's one of the presentations that I've been making on college campuses, just referring to the statistics of the experts. Today, we're using up 1.3 Earth planets. And there's a problem, there's only one. So, then you have statistics of, over a period of time, how something that's used becomes, again, usable. So that's why, you know, greens, you can recycle more quickly. But it's, you know, if it's all green, it's still not fast enough. And the population is growing. Not only factories are growing and cement, you know, the consumers are consuming more, and that means they need stuff. So it just, you know, statistics are, it's not sustainable. So it's going to implode. And we're seeing some of it in the world economy. It's just totally artificial, as you know too well, given your job. And what happens? People are going to go crazy. People are going to, you know, there's wars over. There's an agency in Munich that just monitors the wars of the world. And, you know, how many of the wars of the world are based upon resources? It's an escalating percentage, but it's something like 60% presently. Just fighting over resources. You know, it's like dog growling over a bone. That's what it is. Only it's not just showing their teeth, they're showing their weapons. But it will implode.
there will be a shortage of food in March.
Yeah. That's a whole other. The those who study this are saying that new president's administration, he will seriously have to address not just for third world places, the United States, shortage of food. And not just for the homeless, it's, you know, for people. Because the whole system of how food is produced is unsustainable. You know, so one suggestion is become vegetarian. That takes a lot of load off. But they're not going to do that because of greed. Make social change to get people to, you know, become vegetarian instead of eating meat, and, you know, change the greenhouse effect and have enough food for everybody. No way. Unless there's something that happens at a deeper level. Something. Some people will listen to that message to some extent, but it's not going to change the direction of the ever-expanding population of the world. It's not sustainable. That's, you know, that means it's going to collapse. How many cars can you fit on a bridge until it collapses? And when it collapses, it's calamity. Yes?
How does this figure in with the golden age for 10,000 years?
Ask Donna Kelly. She knows all about the golden age. She was asking about it the other day. What it has to do, one dimension is, in this age of Kali, there is a dispensation, that is, there's an elevator to the top for those who take shelter of Lord Chaitanya's teachings and the chanting of the holy name. Around us, Kali Yuga is going. Those who take shelter of the holy name can get relief from the harassment that those that are going through that. And not only relief from the harassment, but elevation to the stage of spiritual perfection. That's the golden age. And the clock is ticking. Yeah.
In today's verse, we are hearing how the personality of Kali is breaking the legs of the Dharma bull.
Yeah.
Apparently with the objective of destroying the medical culture.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that in society, Brahmins are those with the most faith. So I was wondering what the correlation is between one's developing faith in Krishna and the practice of regulative principles, because many people in different religious traditions argue, well, what does it matter what you put in your mouth, or if you're celibate or not, or if you gamble or not? What does that have to do with having faith? I have full faith in God, but I like smoke and drink and do all these things. So is there a correlation then between
Brahminical
culture?
Yes. Yes. The standard of the Brahminical culture isn't something that's vox populi, or, you know, today's standard is tomorrow's degradation. Yesterday's degradation is today's standard. It's not vox populi, it's standard. There's a standard of Brahminical culture. And the further we go away from that, a Brahminical principle, then everything becomes degraded and Kali has prevailed. The breaking of Brahminical culture has been successful. There's a direct correlation, if I've understood your question.
Well, my question is, well, how does the breaking of the regular principles cause people to not have faith in God? Because people argue that I can...
Well, let me address that. Someone just forwarded to me an article where... I forget the agency, I think it's PEW, it's Pew, like in a church pew, did a study about people in America today. They're just like, you know, amazing that 70%, they did three studies. I'll forward it to you. Three studies. One study, outside of Christianity, is it possible to attain the heavenly realm or something like that? 70% of the Christians interviewed said yes. So, you know, that was given to some Christian organizations. They said, oh, they must not have understood the question. So they reworked the question so that it would not be misunderstood. And it came out 65%. And then they asked some other questions that a gross atheist, I forget what the percentage, large percentage of people said they also can attain heaven. You know, equal opportunity. It's just because they're sincere, they're atheists. But, you know, it's all over the map what people have faith in. I could get lots of laughs by describing discussions that I've had, just direct discussions with people that believe what the soul is. It's amazing what, you know, misinformation that faithful people have. That there's no standard. So, faith in God, what does that mean? Okay, there's faith in a superior power. That's good. Something greater than me. And that's something that's greater than me. What does he care what I eat? I have faith in him. You know, even religious people, the family that I grew up in, when I was asked by my mother and father, why are you vegetarian? I didn't want to answer because I thought it would cause a problem, and it sure did. I said, you know, because it says in our scripture that we are to protect animals. It says in the Old Testament, you're to protect animals. So we don't eat those that we're supposed to protect. And they said, you know, but it says in the Bible, man was given dominion over the animals. And I made the mistake of saying, when I was small, you had dominion over me. But that doesn't mean you put me on the table for your dinner. And my mother cried and ran away from, you know. My father said, why did you make your mother cry? Don't ask me any more questions. Something as simple as that. And they're, you know, religious people. Faith in God. Church every Sunday. Very active in the church. Raised us with, you know, moral values that I still retain. I very much value those moral, some of those moral standards that I got from my parents. But that's a direct application of what is verminical standards. So, and so faith means having a proper understanding of faith in what? You know, like, what is heaven? By being religious, you go to heaven. I forget which organization it was. There's, in Boston, there's like a one of those multimedia things. You go into this multimedia thing, and they have, you know, you're a nice member of this particular faith, and they're riding along, and there's a car accident. You're riding in the car and going on vacation. They're happy, and then you hear the lights go out and a screech and crash and a car accident. Then you hear harp music, and then the light starts to come on, and there they are, in heaven, with turkey on the table and fighting, and television going, and they're in, you know, whatever it was, religion heaven. That's their idea. They have faith. Just live that way, and that's what will happen. Etc. So there has to be proper guidance for those that can see qualified brahmanas. And the deterioration of brahminical culture leads to this. No one to guide people. So somebody comes along and says, I'm a teacher, I'm a priest, I'll teach you. On the way to the Detroit temple, every time I pass by, I can't help it. Over to the left, there's an I am what I am church. Have you seen it? Something else? Premananda?
I happened to come through the very recent book of Mukunda, and I saw that there is this Saint Benedictine. They seem to have, at the time, whenever it was that Saint Benedictine lived, they had some...
they had some standards.
Standards, and real, looked like regulative principles.
Yeah, they did.
And so they lived there pretty kind of...
monastic, very strict life.
Very strict life. And so, can we say, like, because they had strong faith and they had worship, so can we consider that as bhakti and mukhi sukriti, which would take them to the next step? Why not?
It's... The potential is if they meet a devotee. Now, one who's carrying in this, the devotion means in disciplic succession. So there's faith in God. So there's piety. That's the standard for having piety. There's not just helping little old ladies across the street. It's faith in God. Faith in God. So there's faith in God. So there's piety. But now, what's the idea of, let's say, here's a contrast between faith in God and bhakti. One is, before you eat your food, you say thanks to God. That's piety. That's how I was trained. And in bhakti, it's when you take the earnings and go out to buy the things that are going to be prepared, it's purchasing for God, cooking for God, offering to God, taking the remnants of that which came from the offerings to God. That's bhakti. The other is thanks. Piety. So, if there's... You see the distinction?
Yes. And yet, you know...
Now, what's the destination of those persons? Prabhupada was once asked, if someone became a perfect Christian, what would be their destination? And Prabhupada replied, if they could become a perfect Christian, their destination would be Satyaloka. Brahmaloka. Attain the planet of Lord Brahma. And there... in Brahmaloka, in the association of devotees of the Lord, they may go further. So it's piety. It's the Bhagavata metaphor is making wet wood into dry wood. That's piety. Taking out the water from wood, because then dry wood can ignite. But dry wood doesn't ignite by itself. You need some fire touching the wood, and then it can ignite. An example of bhakti on Mukhi Sukriti is engaging in not just helping little old ladies across the street, it's doing some service for the devotees, the Vaishnavas, even unknowingly, doing some service for the Vaishnavas, and therefore the value of Vaishnavas on the planet is especially valuable. Someone comes and puts, you know, something on the altar to give, that happens all the time in our temple here in Chicago, and that's direct devotion. Or someone gives, anyway, Prabhupada's examples are Sankirtan devotees go out and they receive some contribution from the public. And then with that, Sankirtan devotee is transparently placing that in the worship of the deity, so it goes into the treasury, and the treasury spends some money for the worship of the deity, and the devotee is on the altar performing the worship of the deity. That person that gave that donation gets the same spiritual benefit as the devotee that's on the altar, although it was unknowing. There's the bhakti and mukhi sukriti.
You all also already explained their destination, but I was thinking because there seems to be the lifestyle they have, and even though they may not follow this bhakti and mukhi sukriti, they are eligible candidates for.
Yeah, they're more likely to ignite than those that aren't following those standards. They're the dry wood, they're ready to ignite. Like Prabhupada visited, in Australia, it may have been a Benedictine society in Australia.
I think it was Franciscan.
And Prabhupada was, it was remarkable. He was just appreciating how their teachings are so elevated. And their way of life was so elevated. And speaking of Christ, and, you know, as a avatar of the Lord. And, you know, very, very, very much appreciating. And they were much, very much appreciating his appreciation. And as well his, you know, his the teaching of what Krishna directly says. They were then they were being ignited by his association. Say different than the bishop, whoever the person, Cardinal Danielieu in France, who Prabhupada couldn't even convince that the animal has soul. Because there's no regulation. Therefore we eat meat, because animals don't have soul. There's no killing. Prabhupada said, where is that in your Bible? Animals have no soul. He didn't answer. He just said, you know, animals don't have rational faculty that humans have, and that's the difference. You know, consciousness covered or consciousness more elevated because of that brahminical regulation. That's the difference between that and a Vaishnav. Bhakti comes from the Vaishnavas. One last question, then we'll have kirtan for a while.
Like
asking, what?
When devotee on call, he is asking a question. Sarita Prabhu from Oregon. So the question is, there are millions of people in this world who might not know about the Supreme Lord Krishna, and they might not pray and think of the Lord, but still they survive and some of them are rich. So how Krishna cares about all those who do not even think about him, and how all these people are connected to Krishna?
Well, Krishna is a loving father. Supposing a child in the family, just take it in a smaller frame, a child in the family becomes rebellious, goes away from home, and does bad things. A loving father is not going to say, you know, I don't care about you. Krishna is providing facilities according to their misuse of free will, but embedded in that providing the facilities is the message that says, this isn't going to satisfy you. It's by design like that. Dukkha layama shashvatam. And that unhappiness, that dukkha, is the message. So the people don't want the message. They want sukha. They want sense gratification. They think sense gratification means happiness. So he doesn't dismiss them. That's one of the things that we were discussing today. He hides himself inside their heart. He's giving them messages that way. They're ignoring him. He doesn't ignore them. Makes arrangements according to their misuse of free will, but still advising them and making the arrangements within the creation that sends messengers and some. But he doesn't force. He doesn't interfere with the free will. So the loving father, Krishna, is feeling unhappiness because of this circumstance. His part and parcel, some number of his part and parcel living entities have unnecessarily suffering. And the devotees of the Lord, the Vaishnavas, recognizing that anxiety of the Supreme, they take the trouble upon themselves to try to do something. Okay? In service to the Supreme Lord. So, this is the first program in this house, right?
Yes. First?
This is our housewarming. We're making the house warm. By our presence. It's a great space. Did this have something to do with your selection? Nice space. Okay. So, some of you came straight from work, have not had prasadam, will not keep you longer. We'll make some arrangement for prasadam, and while that's happening, we have kirtan. Śrīla Prabhupāda ki
jāya
Grantarāt Śrīmad Bhāgavatam ki
jāya
Gopimanam
ki jāya
So the next Sarvam Prakṣvami ki
jāya